welcome everyone back to another edition of New Books in Education. This is your host, Ryan Allen, on the New Books Network. And once again, I'm very excited. I made some connections through social media and found a fantastic book. So, you know, anyone decrying social media and Twitter should really just get out there and try to find people that are that you're interested in and that post interesting things. So, without further ado, let me introduce Peter Pevarelli, and he recently wrote this book called One Turbulent Year, China 1975. And this is a book where he's a foreign student in China during the Cultural Revolution. Just my mind is blown just hearing this description of the book. And just for connections, his blog, if you want to go check that out as well, sort of excerpts of the book. So if you want to get a little more understanding or you know, you want to read it before you buy anything like that, go check out One Turbulent Year China 1975.wordpress.com. And you can also follow him at SI Theorist, at SI Theorist. Also, you can follow me at Politics and Ed as always. So, Peter, thank you for joining New Books in Education.
No problem. I'm honored that you found me and chosen me for an interview.
Absolutely. Well, I have a personal interest in China, and so this is one of the reasons that I wanted to hear this this interesting story, interesting tale, and I think, you know, because now you're years later, you have academic roots. I think it's especially important.
Yeah, well, at that time, of course, everybody was amazed, not only that I went to China, but before even that I chose Chinese, it's called that, Chinese language and culture as a major, because what the on earth would you be doing, could you be doing with a specialization like that? Because right. No one was doing anything in China, with China, about China.
Right.
And now that's quite different, of course.
Absolutely. Well, yeah. Let's set up what... So what are you doing right now? You're teaching at a university. Can you just maybe give just a very brief, maybe academic background about yourself?
Well, as I introduced, I started studying Chinese, and I was a freshman in 1974, so 1 year before. But before that, I had learned Chinese on my own in an evening course for 3 years, so I actually started learning Chinese when I was 14.
Wow.
And that was mainly, my main interest was languages, foreign languages. It was my fascination at that time. And in Holland, we learn a lot of languages in school, including English, which is good for the interview, of course,
right. Today,
and French, German. I had Latin and Old Greek as well. It's called grammar school in Europe. But I wanted to learn some any non-European language, and Chinese was available in my hometown. It's a small town, and it was even, the course was given in my high school building.
Wow.
So it was the nearest non-Western language that I grabbed, and from one thing came another, so I interested in China. So after 3 years, when I graduated from high school,
right. Yeah.
Choice for Chinese was but nowadays I'm teaching organization theory and as part of business administration course, so it's quite different. But I changed it somewhere in between. But I'm sure we can come back to that later in the interview.
Yeah, absolutely. So just want to set that up where you do have an academic background, which potentially was informed by these experiences that you had when you were younger. Which I think is potentially something that everybody sort of has, goes through or can reflect back upon. I'm surprised that you mentioned your hometown had Chinese language in 19. Would that have been early 70s?
74 or 70? Yes, I started. So it was 1970. It was the first time as well. It was one of those. You have this non-profit organizations that organize evening courses, some more practical, some pure for hobby. And this guy, I think the guy who initiated this, was teaching Russian there. And, at least for Russian, that was a market, of course, during the Cold War.
Right.
But he had this insight that China might be useful or would become author at some time in the near future. So this man was a real insight. And
yeah,
happened. So I think it was the very first evening course in Chinese in the Netherlands.
Wow.
It happened to be, so it's a lot of happened to be a lot of haphazard, haphazardness.
Right. Well, have you, I don't know if you're familiar with Malcolm Gladwell and his outlier sort of theory, where it kind of reminds me of that, where like, you know.
Yeah, well, I use the word fate a lot in the book. Not that I'm preoccupied with fate, but there were a lot of things. So when I started university in 1974, was also the year that the official exchange of students between the Netherlands and China was organized. I was an official exchange student.
Okay.
So selected and sent by my government. That was the only way to do things with China at that time. And I was one of the first as well. I happened to be there.
Right.
And that was the time that my, of course, then my investment, my 3 years investment in an evening course paid back very well, because I was chosen because of my grades.
Right.
Freshman year, yeah.
Now, so you went there already. How well were your Mandarin skills at that point?
I could speak Chinese very well, I may say, because when I entered, arrived at Beijing, finally, after my 48th trip from Amsterdam to Beijing, much longer than I devoted an entire chapter to that, I could have a simple conversation with the school representative that picked me up there. But there was a Dutch diplomat, a sinologist as well, who was also there to pick me up, and he was quite amazed. I mean, it sounds like bragging, but he was quite amazed. So his first reaction was, why are you doing, why are you going to do this here? Because you can already speak Chinese.
Right. That's interesting. So, before you left, I mean, do you recall like any preparation or what was going on, what did you know of China other than, you know, you knew the language, or what was your conception?
Well, I think, in hindsight, we didn't know much. Of course, I studied Chinese language and culture, the official name of the course, for a year. So we believed to know quite a lot about China already, but actually what was going on in China at that time in 1975, it was, again, as I, the book, the phrase that I use in the book is secluded empire.
Oh.
Our press, and I think it's just in both sides of the Atlantic, our press was quite, like now I can say, quite biased. Of course, it was communist and therefore bad. It was something like the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe were bad, so China was also, must also be bad. But actually, how bad and in what way this evil was typically Chinese, no one could tell. There were, of course, and we knew, people knew about the Cultural Revolution, about young people walking in the streets with the little red book in their hand, shouting slogans. And actually, one of the other reason, apart from my good grades, that I was selected so easily is that most of my fellow students did not even sign up to be selected to be sent to China, because they were afraid, or discouraged, not afraid maybe, but discouraged about all this publication about China at that time.
Right. And so you had no apprehensions, or you were just, you know,
I was brave, I guess. I still am. Not brave. I just, when I want to do something, I just do it and I'll see what happens. I'm confident that I can, you know. And of course, I'm confident that when your government sends you to region to study for a year, as part of an official agreement between two governments, that, I mean, you will not end up, you know, being beaten up or, you know, imprisoned or whatever can happen to you. I was quite confident that it was. I mean, the worst that could happen to me was that I would end up at a campus.
Right.
That it would be very hard to leave the campus. And we were very surprised that we were extremely free, at least within the city limits of Beijing, to use the bus and walk around from day one. So
yeah. Well, why don't we? What happened to that? What, tell us. You know, when you got there, or how did you get there? What was that like?
Well, we flew with KLM. Of course, you get this. You know, that's part of the. It's our national carrier. It still is. But nowadays, I fly about 5 times a year. And you, Beijing or Shanghai or Hong Kong, and Beijing is 9 hours, 9.5 hours, Hong Kong 11, 12, and Shanghai somewhere in between. But at that time it took me 48 hours. It was a DC-8. Of course, you may not even know You know a DC-8, but you probably haven't seen a DC-8 in the inside.
Right, yes.
But it's a flying bus for us. I mean, our terminal is a flying bus with something you use in domestic flights. So it was Amsterdam, doing it by art, Athens, someplace in the Middle East, Pakistan. It was Rangoon in Burma. So I saw a lot of small exotic air strips.
Right.
Airfields, and then end up in Hong Kong, 10 o'clock in the evening local time. So the hotel was booked for us. We slept there for a night. And then the next day, take train to the border, the Hong Kong-Chinese border.
Right.
Get off the train, walk with the suitcase in your hand over a small wooden bridge to a small village called Shenzhen. And now, of course, it's the Shenzhen Special Economic Zone, city with millions of inhabitants.
Right, right.
Then wait for the local train and take the local train to a city called Guangzhou, Canton.
Yeah.
Picked up, of course, by someone there already. People knew that was there. Then take another flight from Guangzhou to Beijing. So it was about 48 hours.
Right, right. And who are these other people, these other students with you on this trip?
Well, this particular trip, we were two Dutch students. The other Dutchman was not even studying in my own university, not in Leiden University. And Emmons, he was a Dutchman studying at School of Oriental and Asian Studies, so as in London.
Okay. But
he applied because he was Dutch, and he wanted to be a diplomat, and he became a diplomat afterwards. And I think he made a very good impression with the selection committee, so he was selected as well. And both of us made a trip almost to the end, but when we are in Hong Kong, he noticed that his suitcase was still in Amsterdam.
Oh.
He preferred to wait for another day in Hong Kong to enter China with his luggage, which is probably very sensible. So I arrived on my own. Beijing.
That
happened. Yeah.
So what? When you get to Beijing, what sort of reception? What kind of welcoming do you guys have, or do you have?
Well, there was they were all called teachers. It was the guy in charge of the foreign students. But in Chinese, you call them teacher because they are an official of the school that was picking me up. So he was there. And there was someone from the embassy. That's something, of course, that would not happen to you nowadays. Nowadays, you arrive at the airport and you'll try to find your own way or you're taken up and out. But when we were met with it was very official, with a car, a driver, driven to school. So it's, you know, I was 19 then, so for a 19-year-old student, of course, if you feel very, very comfortable. It's far, far cry from this, all these ghost stories that we were told and that we could read in the media. China. Yeah. We were VIPs, actually. We were treated like VIPs. Of course, I mean, we were VIPs in the Chinese eyes.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And this was the first student delegation since, I guess, from maybe Western Europe, since when, or when?
Yeah, well, since, I think, there were not really, probably there were exchange students, and some students went to China on their own in the 50s, 60s, because they liked China, that's just the other type, the zealots, the what I call it, also in the book, the leftists, when the people wanted to be in China, to study in China, because they, you know, for political reasons.
Yeah.
But I think I was the third part of the third batch of European students that studied in China in an official way, in the line of official exchange programs, since the establishment of the People's Republic of China. So I think before 1973, the only foreign students in China were those non-Western students, that is. The Western students were those who went there for political reasons, and they went there on their own. They sought out the Chinese embassies or whatever the representative office there were, and they went there for political reasons on their own account. But we were, I think it was 1973 that the exchange started. And yes, as you mentioned, right, the Europeans, because they were not Americans yet.
Right.
From both sides, I think the American government was not encouraging, to say the least, American students to go to the PRC.
Yeah.
China was not ready yet, I guess, for an exchange program like that. That changed rapidly, of course, soon afterwards. But at that time, there were no Americans, so it was Europeans and many non-Europeans, you know, from developing countries.
Sure. With Mao's sort of reach out to the developing, quote-unquote, third world, I guess.
Yeah, well, they were different types of students, of course. I mean, we had students, African students or students from Southeast Asia who went to China to study metallurgy, medicine. And the apex was an Albanian student who went to China to study Spanish. Because he would not be able to go to Spain or South America to study. The only country Albanians would be able to study, the only foreign country Albanians would go to study wherever, was China. So it were funny things that you, it was, and it was funny in an interesting way. We were interested, I was open.
That's
extreme. I'm not a political person, I've never been, but it was interesting. It's interesting to observe this kind of anomalies that an Albanian would study Spanish in Beijing instead of Madrid or Barcelona or you know, what have you. Well, that was politics for you.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, we forget that not too long ago in sort of our history, just with this political shift in the world, that it's pretty amazing now. I mean, you can, basically, students are all over from everywhere.
Yes, of course. And as soon as the Americans came, they came in hundreds and more of a, but that's, of course, it's there is a lot of interest. It's
right.
It was the only, for me also. It was the, I've never met an Albanian before, so you don't meet you wouldn't meet Albanians in Western Europe. So it was we didn't only learn. It's also part of the book in many chapters. It's not only we didn't only learn about China. We learn a lot about the world and other peoples and. It was so from that point of view, well, it was a much more comprehensive human experience, apart from, of course, learning a lot about Chinese, speaking Chinese very well, and, you know, learning about the country by looking and talking with people. But we learned so much more.
Absolutely. So which university were you kind of stationed in Beijing?
It was not a real university. It was called the Beijing Language Institute. Nowadays, it calls itself a university. I think it's the official name now is Beijing Language and Culture University.
Okay.
But it's called the Beijing Language Institute, BLI. And it was, well, what it is, a language school. So it was a school where foreigners learn Chinese.
I see.
And it was set up for foreigners to learn enough Chinese to go to a real university to follow courses in Chinese.
Right.
So it was originally set up for these people from developing countries. Well, you can imagine that you are from Uganda and you're sent to China to study medicine. You need to learn a lot of Chinese in order to follow courses in Chinese about, you know, medical topics. And then since 1973, it was open for Western European and Japanese students as well.
Right.
Special classes for Westerners to study Chinese.
And so,
they did a very good job, I must say. It was a very good good school.
Okay. Yeah, that's quite interesting. What when you're at the university or this school, is it like a compound?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, campus. We were housed in a campus building. It's still there. Visited recently.
Okay.
There's some changes, but it looks very old. So it's an old building, and we know it was a dorm with two people in a room. First half year, I shared a room with the other Dutchman, and I think in January or February we got Chinese roommates, which was also quite amazing that they let us share a room with the Chinese. So that was another surprise.
Right.
And yes, there were Chinese studying a number of foreign languages.
Sure.
Mainly elderly people. Well, elderly, of course, not 50s and 60s, but in the 30s, typically people who needed a foreign language for their job. I guess that's also the reason why they were very confident to expose them to a bunch of European European students with all their parties and all the thing. Of course, that's another theme that's all over the book. Of course, then you have these young Europeans in the 1920, 21. I was trying to emulate, that's the word, emulate your student life in Western Europe.
Right. How did that work?
As well as we could.
I mean, were you able to replicate it or were you guys?
Well, you know, it involves beer and wine. And of course, when I, and that was available, there was beer in China. It's, no potato chips all the time and all, but there were things to liquor was cheap. It was vile. Most of it is horrible Chinese Pinot Joe, very strong, 50-60% alcohol.
Right.
But we start to beer, and that's all right. And, well, we had these parties. I mean, not every night. We are drunk all the time. But we had these parties, and no one objected us having these parties. In that respect as well, we were quite free to do. We were not renting the building or anything, but we had parties, and quite a few big parties, and okay. We did things, and we went out to dinner.
Okay.
We sought out. I quickly developed a small group of students, like 5-6 real friends. Their names pop up as well in most of the chapters. Sure. And one of our hobbies was checking out restaurants. Eating was cheap for us, and again, it was open. We took a bus, and we had bikes. Some bought bikes, and we actually were given bikes. We were lent bikes by the Dutch embassy. Very nice gesture.
Right.
So we were cycling around, and we were trying out restaurants all the time. So it was actually quite...
Yeah, what was it like, I mean, just riding your bike around Beijing? Was it... Would you cause a stir just sort of being there? Or by
Sometimes you would draw a crowd. It was right in Beijing. It was more intense in other cities. We made a trip and during the winter holiday, around Chinese New Year. So you would draw crowds on that. But it was okay. I think it was quite pleasant. We draw attention, but not excessive.
Right.
It's also the behavior. I think some of my fellow students drew more crowds than others. It depends on how you behave, of course. I try, usually, and still do, try to blend in. Every now and then, I seek out small places. Well, I was in Tibet for the first time only this year, in June.
Oh, wow.
So I seek out smaller places. And, well, people notice you, but you can behave in a way that it's almost like natural.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I mean... You're here, it's the mid-70s. Just the fact that probably not a lot of foreigners are there in the first place, but then you add on top of this that it's this insane moment in history called the Cultural Revolution.
It was the final year of the Cultural Revolution. We didn't know that, but it was the final year. And so in hindsight, of course, you know that there was quite a lot of... Local politics was really fermenting, and you wouldn't see that very explicitly. But in hindsight, we were given signs, and we could see signs and read signs that China was not as stable politically as it appeared to be on the outside. So a lot of things happened, and of course, the biggest event was January. I think it was in January. The Premier Zhou Enlai died, the man who had been Prime Minister of China since the beginning, because they have elections and all these things, so they never change a winning team.
Right.
And people were really sad. There was another politician who died in only a few weeks before, in December. There was a little commotion, but people were quite... there was not really a real reaction, but when Zhou Enlai died, we had a few teachers spontaneously breaking out in tears.
Wow.
During classes, which is quite strange, of course, for us to show these emotions.
Yeah,
also in Asia, so we then, you know, this man was liked. Genuinely, it's not a propaganda. On the other hand, of course, we were also joking that people broke out in tears because the only decent politician had died. So now that's the joke we made. Yeah, we made jokes, of course. I mean, we were able to crack jokes, actually. People let us do this. They were not trying to intimidate us. Of course, now the Chinese people were desperate that they were in the hands of all those radicals who had led the Cultural Revolution.
Right.
Mao was dying. We knew that. So we had this entourage around Mao, who was now in charge, and Zhou Enlai was the only moderating factor in Chinese politics at that time.
Right,
and he died. So,
what you? I saw in the book that you had met, sort of consoled Zhou Enlai's wife.
Yes, well, that's what I thought. We were VIPs. We didn't always appreciate that at that time. But the next day, we were asked to get in the school buses again. They took us to all kinds of places, of course, sightseeing, but this time they took us to the hall in the Forbidden City where Joan Lyon's body was placed, and surrounded by a few high politicians and the next of kin, of course, wife. And, we made our round to shake hands with all those people, and of course there were a lot of Chinese before us and after us. Mm-hmm. But that crowd was only a fraction, less than a percent of a percent of the Chinese population who were doing this. So we were quite. We should have been more honored than we felt at that particular moment,
right,
to be able to shake hands with the top leaders of the country, right, because the prime minister had died. We were really regarded, I think, by the government, we foreign students, as especially the Western exchange students, as a kind of diplomats diplomats.
Right.
Was
Mao there? I mean, did you get a glimpse of Mao?
No, he wasn't able. He was in bed. I think most of the time he was not able to get up. He was a plant. It's very disrespectful to use that word, but he was what we say in Dutch, he was a plant. He was a vegetable at that time already. And of course, he had what later would be called the Gang of Four, his wife.
Right.
And her three closest associates were not there either. I think they didn't want to show their face because Joe and I actually was their biggest enemy at that time.
Right.
Of course, in my terms, the moderating factor.
Yeah, okay.
He was out of sight. And later, people started to put up a wreath of flowers on the main square of China, Tiananmen Square. And they were hanging poetry in praise of Zhou Enlai, but also, that's a very Chinese way of doing things, of course, poetry that contained hidden messages.
Right, yeah.
Hey, people, get out of there and, you know, give way to the people, to the other factions. And that culminated on April 5, I think it was. That was the Qingming Festival, the festival what we would call Old Souls.
Okay.
When the Chinese celebrate their or honor their death and clean the graves of the ancestors. And the night before, all the wreaths were taken away and all the poetry was taken away by the police on account of the current government. So, de facto Mao's wife and a concert, and then a rally broke out, a riot, even in
those years.
So in that year, it was early April 1976.
That's
we know about the Tiananmen incident. That was 1989.
Right.
I was in China as well at that time for a company.
Okay, wow.
Later, yeah, but this was the first Tiananmen incident.
Right.
In April 1976, and that's all. And then, of course, that's one of the that's an occasion where these political struggles were surfacing
behind the scenes,
literally to the main square, and people were attacking the great hall of the people. This was, of course, slain down. People were arrested, and it was quiet very soon, and you didn't hear anything about it. But that's a turbulent year.
Right. It was probably just a couple.
It was.
A couple years later, when you know they throw the Gang of Four in jail, and Deng kind of comes back. So you were right there in the mix in that, which is just amazing.
Yeah, we had this slogan after that, after the death of Zhou Enlai, so before the riot, gradually slogans would appear about a certain running dog of revisionism or whatever slogan they had, and we already guessed it was Deng Xiaoping, and then the name Deng Xiaoping came out, so Deng Xiaoping fell then for the second time.
Right.
So when I entered China, Deng Xiaoping was still in the part of the government. He had already been banned once and brought back.
Right.
And during that year, in the period after Zhou Enlai's death, he was demoted again, he was the bad guy again, because his protector, Zhou Enlai, was not there anymore to protect him.
Right. Wow. That's quite fascinating. Can we jump back though? We're talking about all this political, these big moments. How about when you're interacting with with the locals? I mean, did they have any sense of sort of talking about these things that were going on around them, or these incidents that were going on? Or
it was difficult for us to speak to people on the streets. Yeah, we went to shops, let's say, to restaurants. We had discussions. There was a restaurant near the back entrance of the school where, of course, many of us had lunches together within groups, and there was a guy, a waiter, who liked to talk to us. But I think we also engaged in self-discipline or censorship, if you want to, not to bring up extremely controversial things.
Right.
We spent a week, that was also part of course of that period, we spent a week in a commune, so-called a rural commune, or in Chinese terms, a people's commune, so as part of the lessons.
Right.
And then we could speak to people, some of these commune members of the Guoto farmers. But no, we didn't engage in political conversations. I think the most political conversation I had, I mentioned that in the book, was at the end of the winter holiday, which we traveled by train all the time. When we did the train back to Beijing, we spent the whole night there, and I had some discussion with teachers. And this female teacher started on her own account to criticize the people in Shanghai that we had visited.
Oh, wow.
But I'm not sure whether it was this famous Beijing against Shanghai feud, or it's a political feud. We have this thing in the Netherlands, Rotterdam people and Amsterdam people. I'm sure in the United States you have people.
North and South.
North and South. You have people who know the difference. You don't know what it's about. People themselves don't know what it's about. But when you are from A, you don't like people from B, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So we didn't have big... But there was, let's say, in our lessons, in our class, the regular class that we had, that were not the teachers did not, the school did not attempt to change us or indoctrinate us at all.
Okay.
They had already given up on us, or it was part of the policy, or these Western European students are here for, learning about China, in an open way, but we are not going to change, or try to change their minds, or... We were very grateful for that. It was one of the fears had, that we had of a lot of politics, but no, we had not.
So what were you getting taught in the classroom? Was it just language, or were there also politics courses, or just general?
Well, it was indirect, usually all mornings. We had full days, 5 full days and Saturday morning, so it was quite heavy schedule, but it was good. It's all mornings, 5 mornings we had language lessons. It's a book published by the school, with a text and new vocabulary, grammar, and all this stuff, but taught in Chinese, of course, so we were literally immersed. And then in the afternoons, we had one afternoon, we had it's called literature, so we were reading parts, chapters from novels, poetry, parts from plays, and those had political content.
Right.
But so we were indirectly exposed to political content, but not the politics were not really discussed. And we had we had sessions with Chinese students who were studying English. So we spent 1 hour speaking English with them and 1 hour speaking Chinese with us, and that was very pleasant.
Right.
We even had... I'm writing it in the book as well. On Saturday mornings, we even had classical Chinese.
Okay.
And I'm sure that people who are familiar with China don't know what it is, but I think the best comparison is that in Europe, people used to write in Latin. They would speak Dutch, German, French, Spanish, Italian, etc., but they used to write in Latin, scholars, until even the 19th century. So in China, you had classical Chinese, which was the written language for ages, while the spoken language was mainly that spoken.
Right.
Until, I think, 1920s, very very late, the vernacular language, the spoken language, became the national language. So when you study Chinese seriously, you study China, whatever aspect of China, you have to learn classical Chinese. But we were surprised that classical Chinese, we had 2 hours of classical Chinese. And
I think
we were the only class that had that my group.
Right.
It could be part of the fact that one of the political movements was that to criticize Confucius.
Right.
You laugh about it now, but that was taken very seriously. It was taken just before I went to China. It was a new campaign, criticize Confucius. And when you criticize Confucius, you have to read Confucius, which is in classical Chinese. So people started reading classical Chinese more than in the years before.
Right. Well, I mean, now, you know, just in the 70s, you know, criticized Confucius, but now, you know, 2000, you know.
It's different, yes. It's now it's completely turned around. Huh? Confucius is completely in again. It's, yeah. Well, it's he was, well, it was a statue of Confucius for, I think, half a year or something at the...
Right. He was rehabilitated, I think.
That was taken away because it looked like hideous. It was a mistake to put it there. It was it looked horrible.
Right, right. Yeah. Absolutely. Did you get a sense of who these other students were that were with you, these Chinese students?
Well, finally we had a roommate. We had roommates, so we got to know the roommates a little. We were in our 20s, typically, and they were in their 30s and 40s.
Were they, I guess, like, were they party members, or were they...
Oh, probably. They were in companies, probably people who had to deal with foreigners or to negotiate with foreigners. Some of them were engineers who had to read foreign literature.
Oh, right.
Or, mainly English. They didn't take part in our parties, except once.
Yeah, okay.
That was very right about that. My roommate immediately got drunk. fiercely criticized about that. Inside a room with me present was very nice. That's a nice scene in the book. We talked to them about anything. They were very, I think they were very well trained and instructed not to. They were very open in one hand about themselves and where they lived and other families. But again, I think we were also exercising extreme self-censorship.
Yeah, right.
Either by fear or that we didn't like them, we didn't want to hurt people's feelings, and the context was very shallow. I think also includes even the teachers. We had a class teacher, so as our my group had a group teacher, group leader, call them. So a teacher was attached to us, our mentor,
right,
if you want to. But we really didn't know much about him.
Yeah.
I think we kept it like that. Yes, we could have been more inquisitive.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
We didn't know what would be the result of being more inquisitive. So
how about we
left it like that. But I think we talked about China a lot, about ourselves, what we saw and what we liked, what we didn't like, what we believed. We interpreted, of course, we were academics becoming academics. So most of us, of course, the European students were sinologists. We were studying China. We were interested in China. That was quite different from the students from the third world countries who went to China or sent to China.
Right.
They were not even there. Not all of them were there on their own free will to study a typical subject. So that was the big schism, I think, between the Europeans and the Japanese and a few others from some other countries who were studying China in Chinese, interested in the country, and those who were studying Chinese to study whatever that was their major in China and were not really interested in the country.
How about with these other foreign students, especially, you know, maybe you mentioned an Albanian student or these other third world country students?
Well, the Albanians, of course, were special. They had a special relationship with China.
Right.
There were quarrels every now and then between African students and Chinese students and Chinese people in the streets and sometimes even teachers. Chinese, I have to be careful what I say. I said they're not racist, but towards people with very dark skin, that's also part of. Of course, there are in Chinese traditional Chinese superstition. There are people with black faces are usually bad people. On the other hand, the behavior, typical behavior, very open behavior of many Africans conflicted with the more closed, you know, keep to yourself behavior of Chinese. So there were much more conflicts, between, for instance, African students and Chinese students or even people on the streets, quarrels, I think.
Yeah, that's...
We tried to avoid and we did avoid quarreling.
Okay. With your other fellow foreign students there? Did you guys get into politics or this other stuff that you were seeing or going on?
Our conversations. Students, I think even, on both sides of the Atlantic, young students still like to talk politics,
right,
and discuss and debate. And we did a lot of it among ourselves, in our rooms together, during the parties, during the dinners, during the lunches, and the breakfasts. We had three meals a day in the student dining hall. The student dining hall played a very big role in our life. It's also in the book.
Okay.
It was not just for eating, it was for socializing.
Right.
So soon we had tables of people who liked each other. We had a table of people who were interested in China, but not in from a political motivation.
Right.
But there were Westerners who were very motivated. Those were the people, one of the funny things that I mention about them in the book is that Christmas is now in a few days. So on December 25, 1975, at breakfast, there was a German girl and a Swiss boy carrying their books to breakfast, as they would always do.
Mm-hmm.
So we were surprised when he went to your books and said, "We're going to class." I said, "Hey guys, did you know? Look at the calendar. It's Christmas." I said, "No, we are not Christians. We are going to class." But our teachers had told us that we could stay away from class at 2 days.
Right.
Because they knew.
Right.
And of course, secretly we believed, and I'm sure that was right. We were right in believing that they were happy to have a few days off themselves. So right. You can imagine, but they had to go to class at least once to show their face because.
Right,
and so you can imagine, we were trying to imagine the faces of their teachers and their group.
When they went in
there. Students, because they had to teach them. I'm sure they only taught them for an hour or so and let them go. So this kind of extreme behavior to the people like all the leftists, that's what you had in among there was a small minority of European students, but they had the Japanese didn't go to classroom on December 25th, and even some of the Muslim students didn't go to class on December 25th because they celebrated any
right,
just any occasion.
A day off is a day.
Yeah, so there were people like that. Yeah.
So
we respected them. We respected them, but you know, we at least on the outside. But these were
right.
I mean, they were funny people. You don't do things like that. I'm sure our teachers didn't. The teacher didn't appreciate their behavior. They're going to class on the December 25th.
Right.
No, Chinese are very patriots, and I expect other people to be patriots as well, and to respect your own culture, and to live by your own rules.
Sure.
Yeah.
How about I guess kind of wrapping up your trip in China?
Yeah.
What was it like to sort of leave or to go, or was there sort of a decompression period before you left or anything?
We weren't given this. Talk about turbulent years. So we already had bought our tickets again, Beijing, Guangzhou, and then Guangzhou, the tickets to Hong Kong.
Right.
And Sam was waiting for us in Hong Kong. And we were ready to spend the second last night. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up. And my first thought was, who the hell is knocking on my door at 4 o'clock in the morning? And then I saw my roommate already standing at the window and said, "Wake up, it's an earthquake." So it was the big earthquake of July 1976.
Wow.
The epicenter was not in Beijing. It was in Tangshan, an industrial and mining city, near not far from Beijing. But it was so big. It was probably one of the biggest earthquakes in the century.
Right. Wow.
Or ever in human history. Also in terms of casualties, of course, but the earth was really shaking and was like in waves. I've never seen an earthquake. My roommate was coming from an area in North China where they have earthquakes, small earthquakes regularly.
Mm.
So it was a crack in the wall, and we ran down, of course. I had some stuff with me, my passport, I think my tickets. And that's what you do. Your mind doesn't work properly,
doesn't
function properly when your building is shaking from an earthquake, but I took some stuff with me, and I was wearing my wearing clothes actually. I could see an Icelandic student. We had two of them as one Icelandic student running completely naked in front of me,
my gosh.
With only his underpants in his hand, which he put on just before leaving the building.
Oh my gosh!
And then we spent our very last day at the Beijing Language Institute, mainly in the dining hall. It started raining as well, and in the bicycle shed, and walking around a little when the rain stopped. So that was goodbye, saying goodbye for the school for us. So
something
the day that we expected to say goodbye, shake hands with the teachers and everything, we spent, we were in total disarray. at the final evening, we were allowed to spend in the building as well, but not on the top floor. I was living in the top floor.
Right.
We were allowed to pack and bring our stuff to the second floor, I think, and we spent the night in the second floor.
Yeah.
And then left. The airport was intact, so I left Beijing in the plane that I had bought tickets for. That was not a problem.
Right.
But it was very hectic. So even the very last day at the school and was extremely turbulent.
Yeah.
So I think that word is very well chosen, I think.
Wow, that's... That's a send-off. That's some send-off you had.
Yeah, that was incredible. Although, in Guangzhou, then I spent one night there. On the way to China, we spent the day and a night in Hong Kong. On the way back, we spent one night in Guangzhou before we took a plane from Hong Kong. We met one of our fellow students who was traveling then, and he didn't know. He had heard rumors about that something was going on in North China, but he didn't know, and also the hotel staff. So news of this huge earthquake didn't travel very fast.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah. But as soon as we boarded the train in Hong Kong, or we got from the we ended the border formalities and we were back in Hong Kong and boarded a train, we were attacked by journalists because we were the first people, at least the first Westerners coming from Beijing, from the earthquake area.
Right.
So it was almost 2 days afterwards. Yeah. So that's another turbulent experience. So instead of sitting down in the train enjoying the scenery to Hong Kong, we were interviewed by local newspapers and local TV. It seems that they expected horror stories, but there was not much horror going on at our school. The biggest horror was that my transistor radio had fallen down from the cupboard and didn't work anymore, but didn't function anymore.
Right.
But no. And, yeah, an Ethiopian student who also was used to earthquakes in his hometown jumped from the fourth floor instead of using the stairs and broke his leg.
Oh my gosh.
That was not very nice. He survived. I've seen him later. Actually, he visited the Netherlands later, years later.
Right.
But so I think the journalists were
a little
disappointed.
Right. So you keep in contact with a lot of your cohort, your student that you.
Yes, I kept in contact with that student, obviously, but unfortunately, he died very young. I think he was 46 or so when he died of cancer. Mm. So, but I ran into the group of five, six people that really became friends. I met a Finnish colleague student twice in China, once in a hotel lobby and once during a conference. So he's now a professor in Helsinki. I met an Icelandic student, one of the Icelandic students once. He became a diplomat.
Yeah, that's amazing.
That's amazing, yes. And years later, I married a Chinese lady. And this year, we celebrate our 30th anniversary in Beijing.
Congrats.
And one of the guests was one of my fellow students from Australia.
Okay.
Kelly, who is... spent half his life in Australia, half his life in China. He's doing China things, of course, and he married one of my classmates, an English classmate of the Beijing Language Institute time. And very recently, because of this book, I found out very late, but that's happened, that there is a Facebook group of students, foreign students studying in China between 1973 and 79.
Right. Yeah.
And of course, I immediately joined, and found quite a few of my fellow students then. And
That's fantastic. That's
I guess it's the age, you know. We do things, a lot of things, and we have a lot of endeavors, a lot of goals that we want to meet. And then when you're in your 50s, suddenly you start looking back. That's also why I wrote this book advanced age. I mean, not old, but still, I could have written it much earlier. But I don't know if I could have written it much earlier, because you need a certain state of maturity to look better. I went back to China for half a year for my first. I have two PhDs, one in arts and one in business administration, with 14 years in between. But for my first PhD, I went to did some research for half a year in China. That's in 1981.
Okay. Yeah.
I taught Dutch in Peking University, 1982 to 1984.
Mm-hmm.
That's when I married.
Okay.
And then I left academia for a while. I joined a Dutch company and was sent to China for 5 years, 1986 to 1991. Wow. So I've seen China move on.
Yeah.
Then after my second PhD, I joined this university again on part-time basis. I still have a company and consulting business. I do this with, now I'm engaged in business administration, still doing research in China. So I spend about 3 months, 3 to 4 months a year in China doing all kinds of things, doing business, so business consulting, doing research, teaching. So I've kept in touch. And
yeah, you feel like your sort of your life has been very informed by.
Oh, yes.
Important decision of studying Chinese at 14.
Right. And the decision was made only or primarily for studying a non-Western language. It could have been anything, but it turned out to be Chinese. So and now we can discuss whether it's fate or there's a higher power, but I think we're not interested in that discussion, at least not here.
Maybe that's the next book.
Yeah, right.
So any concluding thoughts on this one turbulent year?
I'm very happy that I made this decision to sign up for that course, even though China was this secluded empire, etc., with all those people, with all those revolutionaries, with little red books, and that I didn't wait, like some of my fellow students at that time, for a few years later. But I'm very happy that I made this decision, that I was able to experience this final year of this Cultural Revolution period, because it makes you, my entire China experience so much more richer.
Absolutely. Okay.
You know, do what you want to do. Take your chances. So if there is this Chinese course, take it. If people offer you to go to China for a year, do it.
Jump on it.
Yeah. If people offer you to teach in China, teach Dutch in China, which of course never was never was the thing that I would expect to do all my life. You do it, of course, you do it to be in China.
Right.
You know, grab opportunities. I think that's one of the lessons that you can take, even if you're not interested in China.
Yeah, that's fantastic, and I think like you were back there in the mid '70s and. Such a different time, but now we look at China today, and it's almost, I would imagine, almost a whole different country.
Yes, well, actually, when I talk to young Chinese, okay, we have Chinese students here in the Netherlands, and I teach Chinese students sometimes, a few times a year in China, and also in my business life, I meet younger Chinese, even in their 20s, 30s, who work at companies, and actually for them, when their parents talk about the Cultural Revolution, it's like when I heard my parents, when I grew up in the 60s, to talk about the war, which of course was the Second World War. For them, it was the war. But for me, it was something in the past. And for young Chinese, the Cultural Revolution and communes and all this stuff that's really gone through the countryside, that's their parents' stuff. They know about it, but they really don't know what it feels like. And what my experience is not like that. Those young Chinese were really sent to the countries. I mean, at least I had savored that time,
right?
That period, and but it's a very rich experience, and I draw still from that in whatever I do in China with China experience. It's
as I say, now just thinking about how many students are flocking to China. We kind of mentioned before the interview, we were discussing this. And you kind of helped pave the way for this.
Yes. Well, actually, when I observe European and nowadays, of course, many American students, Western students, let's use the word. I must say, maybe I'm too critical. They spend a lot of time in bars. You have bars now. And spend a lot of time with their own people, doing things. Some mix with Chinese, some have relationship with Chinese, but on the average, I think they have there's a lot of more student life now, and they do a lot of more things with themselves than with other people. So when you talk about, when you compare the relationship we had with local Chinese, fellow students, Chinese teachers, Chinese in the streets, there is not that much more interaction than there's before. There definitely is more, but I think it's students are still more secluded and not that more involved in Chinese society as we were, because there's so much to do.
Well, now it's easier.
That's not like student life in Europe or in the United or in North America. And of course, student life is attractive when you are a student.
Right.
Yeah. So. Okay.
I think that's something.
But I don't want to be critical to them. I think it's you. It's not easy to jump into to immerse in a society. And I did my own immersion. Of course, my wife is born and raised in Beijing and still very Chinese. But that's happened when I was teaching Dutch in the early 80s. So a few years later, when China had opened up for a while, and then I could do a thing like that. And I think that's worth another book. So
that,
of course, is I think still the basis of that, the roots of that, grown in this year in China.
Right.
75, 76.
Okay. Well, that's usually the last question that we have on the network. What is next? Do you have another book? Do you have another project, another paper? What do you got going on?
Well, in terms of books, I just less than a week ago I got the green light from Springer. That's a German publisher. I told you I have two PhDs. My first PhD is about the history of Chinese grammar studies, so the history of the way Chinese studied grammar.
Oh wow.
It started very recently because there is no such thing as an indigenous Chinese grammar. Mm. Chinese started learning about grammar in the course of the 19th century when they started learning foreign languages. That book has never been, that PhD has never been published properly. And I have done a revision, and I am still considered the authority on this land. It's a very small, of course, very narrow field. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was worthwhile to do a small revision and then again venture to contact a publisher of where I published before, and now I got the green light, so that's the next thing. So, and that's again something from the past. That's a PhD that I took and got in 1986. Wow. But I'm very happy, I'm very proud that it is going to be republished in a revised edition and properly in a proper book.
Okay. Yeah, that'll be fantastic.
I'm thinking of a book on Chinese grammar still, also. Not the history, but the brand itself. I think grammar still needs to be addressed more thoroughly in language studies. There are still too many people, even sinologists, who claim that Chinese does not have grammar, which is nonsense.
Yeah, but
I want it to be a fun book, not a grammar book, not a reference book, but the grammar book you can read, something like Fun with Chinese Grammar.
I see.
I think it's about 70% ready in a manuscript. And of course, there is the sequel. So it is the sequel, and the sequel will be of this book will be not the half year of research, but the 2 years that I taught Dutch.
Okay.
So it's a spare year. That was the time that China really opened up, and was also turbulent in another year. China was the Chinese were learning so much and sucking up Western culture so quickly that they sometimes choked on it.
Mm.
And I was there teaching Dutch of all languages. I mean, who on earth in China would want to learn Dutch?
I guess a couple. Yeah. Maybe.
We are also patriots, but who wants to learn Dutch? Anyway, there were people who learned Dutch. That's also a period that's worth a book like this.
Right.
Well, but let's first stick to promoting and selling this book.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay.
I hope this interview helps.
Yeah, no, this has been really great. I appreciate it. The story is so fascinating and worth a read for anyone interested in China or even just education, international students, international education. I think there's all sorts of avenues.
Yes. I spent quite a lot of time on how they taught us and how the teachers were really trying to teach us. They were doing a lot of working very hard with the limited means that they had. So it's also about education, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Peter, thank you very much for joining us, and I encourage the audience to go check out Peter Pevarelli's One Turbulent Year, China 1975, from Book Scout, and we'll offer a link to that. And Peter, thank you for joining us. And
It was an interesting experience.
All right. Fantastic. And thank you, everyone out there, and hope you learned something.